Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 40 years ago, we first began hearing the chants, "Death to America" in Iran. It was just one part of the Islamic Revolution that resulted in Iran's government becoming what the CIA describes as a theocratic republic. The U.S. and Iran have been enemies since. Over the past four decades, there have been tensions and threats off and on. But over the past few weeks, those tensions seem to have risen to new levels. Last week, four ships belonging to Saudi Arabia, Norway, and the United Arab Emirates were damaged or sabotaged, and Saudi oil fields in Yemen were struck in drone attacks. No clear proof has emerged that Iran was involved, but U.S. think tanks have said the stealth and use of proxies is consistent with Iran's past tactics. All this has resulted in tough talk like this from U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton.
If you cross us, our allies, or our partners, if you harm our citizens, if you continue to lie, cheat, and deceive, yes, there will indeed be hell to pay.
Tensions with Iran on today's Smart Talk. Joining us as our guest is Dr. Mehdi Norbash, Professor of International Affairs at the Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. Dr. Norbash, good to see you again.
Thank you very much.
And this is an opportunity for you, the listener, to weigh in on what's going on between the Iran, between Iran and the United States. You've heard much of this coverage on the national news, on NPR, but here's an opportunity for you to weigh in. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Norbash, here's the big picture question. How do you see the situation between the U.S. and Iran right now?
Very dangerous. If you look at the way the United States, the Trump administration and the Iranian officials, they talk to each other, it is very dangerous. In the last couple of weeks, it got more dangerous. You know that from May 2nd, the Trump administration imposed total sanction on Iran.
Economic sanctions.
Yes. Eight countries, they were allowed before that to buy the Iranian oil, and now no country is allowed, to buy oil from Iran. The situation is getting, tenser in Iran. And in Iran, for the listeners, they should know that Iran is not Saudi Arabia, Iran is not, Libya, Iran is not, Iraq. In Iran, you have a very strong democratic movement at the moment against the authoritarian regime in Iran. And what in the last couple of weeks the Trump administration, Bolton and others, have done to the Iranian public, to the Iranian political environment, they gave a very even hand to the regime in Iran to control the environment, to control the media. And the democratic movement in Iran is very worried that kind of clash between the United States and Iran will suffocate, at the end of the day, the democratic movement and those voices inside the Iranian society that are pushing, for change in Iran. And this is unfortunately is unfolding at the moment. And the danger of war is over there. And the radicals in Iran, honestly, they are not very much against war with the United States because that, can radicalize the Iranian politics, radicalize the Iranian environment, political environment, both sides. Bolton, Netanyahu, the Saudis, they are looking for a war. Iranian radicals on the other side, they are not looking very specifically for a war, but they are not against it. And that is overall the danger that we can see in Iran at the moment.
But, and there is a but there,
yeah.
When we hear about these attacks on the Saudi oil tankers, yeah, and the oil fields and the Norwegian ship, the UAB, mm-hmm, the United Arab Emirate ships as well, The United States sees that, or the Trump administration sees that, as a danger to shipping in the whole region, that Iran is a danger to the region. Justified in your mind?
Justified to some extent, yeah. Justified to some extent, and but we have to go to the root cause of the current, you know, escalation, and the current escalation is done after the Trump administration rejected the nuclear deal with Iran. And as you know, the Europeans are not with the United States on this issue. And the approach that the Iranian reform, you know, that the nuclear deal in Iran was done under the pressure of the reform movement in Iran. It was not, you know, something that the radical conservatives in Iran, they were looking for it. But under the pressure of the public, they went through, you know, that deal, and that deal was established in 2015. And for the Trump administration to come and, you know, reject it is an international, of course, you know, agreement. That was a blow to a lot of things in Iran. And Iranians knew that if Iran can establish that, you know, deal with Europe and the United States, then that becomes the first step toward de-radicalizing the Iranian politics and go further toward reform and democracy and all of the, you know, those issues. But the tension has started from, you know, that point, and little by little, this administration put a lot of pressure on Iran. You know that in the Middle East, we have Saudi Arabia and we have Iran. When it comes to Iran, the Trump administration is talking about democracy and human rights. But when it goes to the Saudi Arabia, that is totally a different standard. And that is not understandable for a lot of Iranians. And you know, with that background that Iranian has, that in 1953, United States and the British carried out a coup against the democratically elected government in Iran, that is in the background and backdrop of the mind and understanding of a lot of Iranians. And they think that the West and the United States, they expect them to support democracy and not really to push Iran to the corner.
So Iranians remember that? I mean, okay, obviously some who were born since then, but I mean, they remember that kind of history that goes back over 70 years.
Absolutely. And that is a danger. And the danger is this, that this administration does not understand that dynamics in Iran, that Iranian nationalists, and Iranian nationalism is not a hardcore isolation, is not a hardcore anti-pluralism, is a very inclusive type of nationalism in Iran. And whenever the United States confronts Iran, that unifies the Iranian public, because they are afraid that one more time the United States interferes in the Iranian, you know, politics to an end that is not desirable for Iran. That is skepticism is over there, unfortunately. And the Trump administration does not understand, you know, that with a country that went through revolution and a lot of people are in the forefront of the battle for democracy, they have to deal with that country differently.
Mm-hmm. But let's provide some background here, because these things do not happen overnight. Yeah. As is often the case, the Iran nuclear deal negotiated by the Obama administration and agreed to by Iran. Under the deal, in exchange for the lifting of economic sanctions, Iran agreed to reduce its number of centrifuges by two-thirds, decrease its stockpile of uranium by 98%, cap uranium enrichment at 3.67%. Mm-hmm. It was opposed strongly by Israel, which I don't think we can state enough how important that is to the Trump administration. Trump said during the campaign it was the worst deal ever. The U.S. pulled out last year. Sanctions were reimposed year after year, and now they have been expanded. Mm-hmm. Two things stick out. The sanctions, especially against oil exports, you mentioned that. Mm-hmm. But there's also Iran's regional goals, which seems to be to control Middle Eastern capitals from Tehran to the Mediterranean, that apparently Tehran— I don't know if whether brags is the word or not, but often says we now control capitals, a wide swath in the Middle East. So if you would address those two things, you did talk a little bit about the sanctions, but also about Iran's expansionist goals.
There is expansionist. There is, of course, no denial of the Iranian expansionist policies. But we have to understand it this way, that it is not expansionism is a type of approach that the conservatives in Iran have. And those people, of course, they have influence in Iraq, they have influence in Syria. And the way to deal with that expansionism, and this is overall, that has been the discussion, that let us finish the nuclear deal and about other policies of Iran negotiate. This is overall the position that the European countries have. But the Trump administration from the beginning said that the nuclear deal is not acceptable to me, to this administration, because that it not includes other, you know, expansionist policy of Iran. But Europeans and a lot of others, they want to separate, you know, these two issues from each other and go gradual. That is the bypass. That is a problem, unfortunately, at the moment, that the Trump administration tries to lump them together and solve all of the problem. And it's not for a step-by-step type of approach to Iran. And that has exacerbated the situation at the moment in the Middle East and the tension that you can see.
The Trump administration has said that it is trying to deter and not provoke. But at the same time, people like we heard John Bolton, who has been a hawk on Iran for his whole career, there has been, you know, talk about regime change.
Yeah.
And the administration says now we're for regime behavior change.
Yeah.
I mean, are those things realistic?
When you put pressure economically on a country to destroy its economy, what it means? It means you are looking for the regime to collapse. This is the interpretation that a lot of people have, you know, inside and outside of Iran. Then the Trump administration, Trump himself or Pompeo, is talking about the aim of the United States is not to change the regime in Iran, but definitely in the backdrop, that is what they are trying to do. And because of that, there is a huge resentment. And Bolton, you have to have, you know, that background that Bolton is one of the architects of the American invasion in Iraq. And that person to be in the political scene of the United States and making Americans, you know, foreign policy, that scares a lot of people inside the United States and, you know, inside Iran. Then they can say that the goal is not to change the regime in Iran, but anybody know that that is the ultimate goal. Iranians, those who are for democracy in Iran, that they have a different view. They are for a gradual change in Iran because the drastic change, the revolution, the collapse of the regime is not the way to go for them. They can see that the lack of alternative at the moment in Iran in terms of chaos and those things, if that ensued in Iran, then that is not in the benefit of course, Iran or any country. And especially in the Middle East, in that volatile environment, that countries are, you know, close to each other and a lot of animosities, you have to be very careful in that part of the world. There are a lot of unresolved problems in that part of the world that can ignite tensions. The Arab-Israeli conflict, there are other things, the tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia, the Shia-Sunni, you know, conflict at the moment. Then you have to have a gradual approach. You cannot change things overnight. And that is what a lot of Iranians want from inside, of course, you know, and outside the country.
But those who are in Iran who support democracy and expanding democracy, do they want regime change? I mean, it's been a brutal regime over the past 40 years. Human rights, you mentioned. Expansion, you mentioned. Yeah. Do they want regime change?
They want regime change, but they do not want the collapse of the regime. all of a sudden. They want to change the regime gradually. They want to change the regime in a process. They want reform. They don't want revolution. They don't want the, you know, total disintegration of the Iranian politics, because they can see the danger in that kind of approach in Iran. And they want overall, you know, support for that kind of approach. They want regime change, but they don't want, you know, the collapse of the regime at the moment.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Before we get back to our discussion, wanted to mention that on the 6th of June, the 75th anniversary of D-Day, Smart Talk will be on a road trip to the Eisenhower Historic Site in Gettysburg, and we invite you to participate. You can go to WITF.org and RSVP. I know that we have a lot of people who are coming out. We'd love to see you there. We'll be talking about D-Day and the 75th anniversary. President Eisenhower, who, of course, was the commander-in-chief, the architect of the D-Day invasion. That comes up on June 6th in a little less than 2 weeks coming up. Well, it is 2 weeks, I guess, from today coming up. But go to WITF.org/events and you can RSVP. Today we're talking about another possible war, but I don't know. No war is glorious, and it is not something to be celebrated, that's for sure. But right now, tensions between the United States and Iran. Our guest, Dr. Mehdi Norbash, professor of international affairs at the Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. If you have a question or a comment, we're getting a number of comments here. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You also can go to Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we take some of these comments, Dr. Norbash, you have family in Iran. Mm-hmm. What's the situation on the ground, the daily lives of Iranians right now under these economic sanctions?
Very difficult. 50% inflation. The prices, you know, jumped overnight, increased radically overnight. Close to about, this is the last estimate that I have seen, close to about 40 million Iranians on the edge of poverty. We are talking about the country that has 80 million population. Iranian has never faced, of course, they went through war, they went through calamities after the Iranian Revolution, but this is a test. This is a huge burden on the Iranian politics, and something that the audience or the listeners, you know, should know. In Iran, close to about 75% of the population, they are under 40 years old. Iranian revolution took place 42 years ago. They do not know anything about the revolution, and they perhaps, you know, they do not want to know anything about the revolution. Whatever they have seen during the years in Iran in the last, you know, four decades has been misery, has been not really a life that they desired. Iranians are highly educated. They are highly outward looking. They are very much close to the Western mentalities. And they want change. They want change in Iran, and the situation is getting harder and harder. And they blame, of course, the Iranian government, but they blame, of course, the Trump administration too, because they don't want, you know, a drastic change in Iran. They want, you know, gradual change. They don't want those guys who are looking for opportunities to militarize the Iranian politics. You know that Sepah, the guard, is very much controlling a lot of avenues, political avenues in Iran. They don't want those guys to get an opportunity to impose themselves on the society. And this is overall the internal danger to the Iranian politics at the moment.
When was the last time you spoke with family members?
I talk to them on a regular basis, 2-3 times in the week. But as you know, I cannot go back. I'm very, of course, outspoken. I talk on BBC. I write. And this is overall, you know, my life.
But what have you heard about the last few weeks? I mean, as we're sitting here talking about tensions right now, what do the people of Iran hear about the tensions?
They are very afraid. They are very afraid for a war because they have gone through 8 years of war with Iraq. And a lot of people, especially those who were born during that time, or they were young, you know, at that time, and they tasted the experience of those years of war, the chemical attacks of Saddam Hussein on Iran, the bombing on major cities of Iran by Saddam Hussein. They are very afraid, very afraid. And they are pushing in every way, you know, that they can they can do to discourage that kind of, you know, mentality in Iran and outside. You know that there is a huge campaign at the moment outside of Iran and inside of Iran, no war with Iran. And millions of Iranians are participating in that kind of campaign.
Tell me if I'm wrong here, but we've often heard, and you just said that 75% of the Iranian population under the age of 40 is that Iranians, especially young Iranians, like American or Western culture, pop music, theater, entertainment, art, that kind of thing. But yet, just the other day, there's a story, just a little story about, I think it was a kindergarten class, that was singing pop songs, and the regime said, you know, this is the West way of trying to infiltrate our minds. I mean, we hear something like that, we think, this must be, you have no freedom. And crazy is the word.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that shows the Iranian culture. That shows the perspective that the Iranians have, that any American who has traveled to Iran and sat with Iranian knows that Iranian, they love American, they want to have that relation. You know that United States is the first destination for Iranians to come to educate themselves. They don't want to go to Europe. They don't want to go to any other, you know, countries. From the past, that has been a tradition well established in Iran, and they don't want to see any animosity between Iran and the United States. They you know that the in the 1930s and 1940s, Iranian hired an American accountant. I forgot the first name, but I know, you know, the last name, Schuster. He was so good to Iran. He really put the books, we are talking about the accounting books of Iran, outside the influence of the British and the Russians. Iranians have a good memory of what the United States have done for Iran before, of course, 1953. You know that Truman administration was very much for the Iranian oil nationalization and Mossadegh. They had a very good relation. When Mossadegh, the prime minister, the democratically elected prime minister of Iran, came to the United States for the first time, the mayor of Philadelphia gave the key of the city as a symbolic gesture to Mossadegh. Iranians do not forget those, you know, memories, and they want to have relation with the United States, and they see, of course, impediment, you know, here and there.
But the propaganda that they get, what they hear from the government is that, you know, America's bad, the West is bad.
But they reject it. They very much, of course, stand against it. They do, you know, whatever they want to do. And believe me, they do. They do. Yeah. If you come, you know, to the streets, if you go, you know, here and, you know, there, you see that, you know, the reaction of the Iranian public is totally different from the government.
Let's take some emails. Jose emails, since 9/11, I do not trust anything the U.S. government says about other countries, especially this administration. It's clear that this administration is intent in provoking Iran into a war. The Trump administration has no clue about what the price to pay for war is and are behaving irresponsibly without disregard to the potential for thousands of human lives that will be lost on both sides of if we go to war. Remember Iraq. Now, you know, there is a segment of the population in the Congress here in the United States that is suspicious that this is the Trump administration is following the pattern of the Bush administration in 2003 under false intelligence going to war in Iraq, that this is the same thing. False intelligence, really no intelligence in this case. Your thoughts?
What is scary, of course, you know, I agree with them. They are cooking a war with Iran. They are pushing, they are encouraging a war with Iran, especially Bolton and those guys in this administration. But something that we have to know, Iran is not Iraq. Iranians are very much against the war. The country does not have the type of demographic condition that Iraq had at the time of the United States invasion. And Iranians do not want, you know, that war, you know, to take place. And they are very nationalistic in that sense that they don't want...
You're talking about the people.
The people, right. Yeah, the people, right. The people. And that is the scary part of, you know, the whole thing, that a war with Iran can very much, of course, damage many things inside Iran and in the Middle East. And there are, unfortunately, some people in this administration that they do not understand the ramification of a war with Iran.
Let's take a phone call from Frank in Mechanicsburg. Frank, you're on the air.
Yes. Yes, I agree very much with the professor that Americans that have traveled to Iran that I've heard over the past 30 or 40 years have always described the friendship of the Iranian people toward Americans. And I also feel that John Bolton is trying to provoke war against Iran. And I think that's very unwise and foolish.
Frank, thank you very much for your call. I mean, just at least the emails we're getting and the thoughts that we're getting, it seems as though Americans are suspicious of what they're hearing from the government.
Yeah, yeah. And in academia, in other places, in the Congress of the United States, even some Republicans, and that, you know, makes me very happy, they are very suspicious that there are people inside this administration and in the Middle East that are trying very hard to create a type of environment that facilitate a war with Iran, and that can be very dangerous.
Let's take a phone call from Tony in Lancaster. Tony, I hope we don't get to the point where you're talking about, but what is your question?
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with this guy. Apparently most of your callers do, too. I mean, Iran is always some sort of monster, and we're the good guys. That's hardly the case. But anyhow, the point is, I would ask the professor and anybody who's listening to the show, what would a war with Iran look like? We don't have the guts or the willpower to do another Vietnam, which would it be if we put ground troops in there. So what would a war with Iran look like? Just bombing places in the rubble? What does the professor think a war would actually look like when it came about?
Thank you very much for your call. I hope we never get to that point, but...
Absolutely. Very dangerous war. Very dangerous war, because Iran and the Guard, they have forces in other, you know, part of the Middle East. And if they unleash them, then that cannot be a very... That can be a different war. A very different war from the war that United States waged against Saddam Hussein. Iran, as I said, is a different country. These guys, I'm talking about the military and the guard in Iran, they have created a lot, close to about the estimate that I have, 200,000 of those forces in different, you know, countries of the Middle East, from Pakistan to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon. And it will be a different war. It will be a very, very ugly war. Let's, you know, put it this way.
Just a couple minutes left, Dr. Norbash. You know, one of the criticisms, and when we look back at the United States at war with Iraq, was that we wonder whether it was learned or not, is that the United States went to war in Iraq not knowing the culture, mm-hmm. not knowing the mm-hmm. country, not knowing the people. I mean, at the time, it was said that the Iraqi people would welcome American troops with open arms. That didn't exactly happen.
Yeah.
What about Iran? What doesn't the United States know about Iran that it should?
Let me tell you what that misperception was. They were thinking that they go to Iraq and they can put back the country together in about, you know, 2-3 months. That was a perception. In Iran, the situation is worse than that, because Iranians will be unified against any foreign invasion or foreign, you know, war. And those proxies that I told you, It will be totally a different war. It is not. It will not be an easy war for the United States, and the level of casualties from both sides. I can't tell you, you know, from now. It will be tremendous. It will not be in a war that United States wage in Iran. Totally a different war, totally in a different nation, totally with a different, you know, culture. And United States should not jeopardize that goodwill of the Iranians and wage a war with Iran. That is a dangerous thing that they have to think about it twice.
One final question. What has to happen to de-escalate the situation?
I think the first step, if the Trump administration comes back and tells the Iranian that we accept the nuclear deal and we want to further add to that nuclear deal, that will be a good starter. And that has been my argument to my country also and over here too, that this is a starting point. To agree with the nuclear deal, that of course it has the support of the England, the British, the French, the Chinese, the Russians, of course, and the French. Start from that point. Don't reject it. When you reject that international agreement that has been approved by the United Nations, it is not a good starter. And let me tell you this. Under the watchdog of the United Nations, I'm talking about the International Atomic Energy, 14 times they have been in Iran, and Iran stood with his side, its side of the deal. Then that would be better for the United States to go back to that agreement and start a gradual type of, you know, approach and negotiation.
I wonder, though, whether that's realistic. And also, Iran has said that, maybe it's a threat, that they're going to not adhere to the agreement. We're out of time.
Okay.
Dr. Mehdi Norbakhsh, who is Professor of International Affairs at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology, thank you very much for your insight. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we're talking about, you know, it's the Memorial Day weekend, unofficial beginning of summer. People will be thinking about vacations, maybe weekend trips. We're going to be talking about places to visit, favorite places to visit, vacationing, tourism here in Pennsylvania. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Tuesday's primary election didn't garner much attention from voters in Pennsylvania. Voter turnout was very low. That's even though local offices, which arguably have more daily influence on voters, were being elected. There were a few special elections and referendums, but again, voter turnout was low. For many, it seems that the 2020 presidential election and Pennsylvania's important role in it is the next big thing to look forward to politically. Joining us to discuss this, the primary and looking ahead to 2020, is Dr. G. Terry Madonna, Director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs and Professor of Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster. Terry Madonna, always good to talk to you.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we're at smarttalkwitf. Again, yet phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Terry, would you agree with my introduction there that, I don't know, this was an off-year election, but really an off-year election if you go by the amount of attention it got from voters, that we're still talking, a lot of people talking about the 2020 presidential election?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And the argument that I've made, and Mike Young and I wrote a column about it just recently, the municipal elections, county elections, in many respects are critical elections, because when you think about your safety, translation, local police, when you think about taxes, the property tax, the most hated tax in our state by far, when you think about fire protection, when you think about something that we perhaps take for granted, garbage collection, right? When you think about all of those functions and how important and critical they are to the daily life of all of us, and then the turnout in some places, 13%, 14%, 15%, It's remarkable. And by the way, the election on Tuesday was no different than past off-year elections in terms of low turnout. Unless there's a controversy, unless there's a scandal, unless there's something that really focuses the attention of voters in a particular municipality or county or even statewide, the turnout in primaries is, in this cycle is just going to be what it was, low, and lower.
Mm. So were there any surprises in Tuesday's primary for you?
Not really. I mean, when you take a look at the elections, I should say, we're really talking about nominations to a party in most cases. The two endorsed candidates running for the Superior Court, one, you know, and by that I mean party-endorsed candidates in the Republican and Democratic parties won. They weren't even close. Mayor Kenney in Philadelphia was reelected. We did have that special congressional election in the 12th CD, as I think everybody, all of your listeners know, a certain guy named Donald J. Trump went up there to campaign. He won handily, well over 30 percentage points. I'm talking about the Republican candidate in that district.
Fred Keller.
Representative Fred Keller. And then there were special elections for the Senate. There were two Senate elections. They were won by Republicans. They were in Republican areas. So the Republican domination of the Pennsylvania State Senate goes from 26 of 50 seats to 28 of 50 seats. Then there was a special election to the House out in the western part of our state. That was also a Republican district, and the House Republicans are now back to 110 of 203, the number they had after the elections in 2018. So, you know, here and there was an upset down in Philadelphia. There was an upset or two in the municipal elections there or in county elections. But overall, mostly uneventful.
Mm. So, as we know, and we've spoken many times about this, in the last 3 years, President Trump dominates the news. I mean, even last year, 2018, with the congressional elections, yes, as we get closer to November, there was more attention on those congressional elections. But all the news, all the political news was kind of a reflection of, okay, Trump this, Trump that, either for or against. Here we are, more than a year from the 2020 election, and we're hearing about Pennsylvania being so important in the presidential race.
Right.
But, you know, one of the questions I have, there's a lot of questions here, but one I have to ask, Terry, is the media focused on the presidential election or are voters or are both? Are voters focused on 2020?
Yeah, I think both. I mean, I think we're going to have we had a huge increase in the midterm elections in 2018 in our state and nationally. I think there isn't any doubt that given the controversy, whether you're for or against the president of the United States, meaning you approve, you like him or you don't like him, what's the bottom line here? The bottom line is that that he's controversial. And the fact of the matter is that we are now riveted on the presidential election in 2020. And in our state, 40 states don't matter. And I don't mean that meanly. I'm not being harsh about it. Why don't they matter? Well, you know the answer. Because they're solidly Democratic or solidly Republican. So the election for the presidency of the United States, if you expand it to the greatest possible point, 10 states. More realistic, 6 to 8 states. Pennsylvania is one of the top 2 or 3 states likely to determine. Now, we're speaking now. You and I can talk over the next year and a half or so, and it might change. Pennsylvania is, some think, the most relevant state in the presidential election. I'll say it's certainly in the top 3. So you can expect more visits from the president. We've already had a number of Democratic presidential hopefuls in the state, and it's all likely to increase. So you're absolutely right. This is the interest in the presidential election is already sky high.
I've heard people say that the next president will not become president, whether it's Donald Trump or a Democrat, will not become president unless they win Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Is Pennsylvania that important?
I wouldn't go that far, but I do think we're critically important here. I mean, the fundamental way to think about it is this. Donald Trump's president of the United States because he won Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin. You and I have talked about that before. Because his campaign developed a particular strategy to go after a segment of the electorate, basically white working class voters. And in our state, they live in the northeastern part and the southwestern part. They're predominantly there. And the Democrats, particularly Joe Biden, fully understand that. And that's one of the reasons that Joe Biden is so popular in Pennsylvania. That's one of the reasons that Joe Biden is popular in this state. So I don't think there's any doubt that here's something else that we could throw into the mix. Of all of the states that are kind of in play, let's put it that way, with the exception of Florida, but if you go to the Rust Belt states, which I talked about earlier, we have the largest number of electoral votes, 20. We're tied with Illinois in fifth place. So when you get that many electoral votes and you're pivotal, meaning it could be won or lost by either party, you fully understand why Pennsylvania is so important.
Donald Trump did not win the popular vote, as we've heard many times. In 2016, he won the electoral vote.
Correct.
Is there the possibility that could occur again?
Oh, absolutely. You can't rule that out. The reason is that you get a very heavy Democratic vote in states like New York and California and Illinois and a few others, but when you look at the pivotal electoral vote states, they provide the difference. Trump ended up with 306 electoral votes. You need 270. Two of his electors didn't vote for him. I joke when it's not a joke, but it's in passing, I say, well, five of Hillary Clinton's electors didn't vote for her. So you can get to the 270 and not win the popular vote, and I wouldn't rule out almost a repeat of what we had in 2016. The difference might be what happens in Minnesota and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And, of course, we have a close election in the state of Florida with 29 electoral votes. That state is also going to get a great deal of attention.
Mm. So, as you said, Pennsylvania will be seeing a lot of these candidates over the next 18 months or so. President Trump in Montoursville earlier this week when campaigning for Representative Keller took a shot at Joe Biden. Well, he's been taking a lot of shots at Joe Biden, the perceived frontrunner, more than just the perceived. The polls have shown that so far. But said that Joe Biden abandoned Pennsylvania. Is that something that would have an influence on people, do you think?
In all respect, that's nonsense. Joe Biden's dad, his family, picked up and left Scranton when the future vice president was 10 years old. He didn't have any say in it. You know what I mean? He had no say in it.
So he couldn't stay in Pennsylvania and let the family go to Delaware.
Yeah, oh, no kidding. Of course he went there.
Yeah.
And he does refer to his Scranton roots. I think he still has a fifth cousin there. The other aspect of it is that during his 36 years in the Senate, he visited Pennsylvania frequently. And Delaware does not have commercial television. They get their TV from Philadelphia, which means when they were covering Senator Biden, for example, Philadelphia television reaches, of course, Philadelphia, the vote-rich suburbs and up into the Lehigh Valley. And so a lot of Pennsylvanians in the Southeast in particular throughout his career were seeing Joe Biden on TV and listening to him on radio on a regular basis. I mean, that just goes without saying.
Yeah, Philadelphia is the fourth largest, might not be the fourth largest city any longer, but the fourth largest media market in the country. So let's look at the Democratic side. You mentioned, I mean, Pennsylvania, yes, an old Rust Belt state, but still has a lot of white working class voters out there. And that was what was attributed to the Trump victory in Pennsylvania in 2016. Does Biden, I mean, Biden right now, the polls have shown Biden would be the Democratic leader so far, this far out.
Right.
Any
of
the other Democrats resonate with Pennsylvania voters from what you see?
Well, Sanders comes in second largely because of his name, you know, and progressive Democrats in particular. But look, this is as wide open a nomination process as we've seen in recent times. Now, you might say, there were 17 Republicans who sought the presidency in 2016, and Donald Trump emerged. But the Democrats are going to go through, I'll call it a battle of one sort. Here's what it is. How far left does the agenda, do they push the agenda? You have the progressives and the center-left Democrats, and they're going to battle it out over an agenda, over a series of policies that are likely to dominate much of the discussion throughout the Democratic nomination process. Biden leads the pack. He has about an 18.5-19 point lead on the average of the polls over his closest rival, Bernie Sanders. In our state, by the way, he has in the Quinnipiac poll a 26-point lead over his closest rival, Bernie Sanders, and that's obviously because of Biden's presence and his popularity, especially among Democrats in the state. So we're going to have to wait and see how this plays out. I mean, at this point, I would say all bets are off on who's going to be the nominee. But by next February, when we get to Iowa and New Hampshire and we go through this process of the Democrats go through the process of picking delegates, I can't believe we're going to have, as we now have 23 or perhaps even 30 before it gets through, the individuals get through saying they're running for the presidency. I can't believe we have that many people in the contest.
A couple of emails here from our earlier conversation talking about local elections. Rebecca says, I voted in every previous election. I also agree that local elections are so much more important than national, but it's so difficult to find information on local candidates, and I'm very uncomfortable voting without an informed opinion. So I do not vote, and I did not vote in this past primary. The way the media focuses on national events as opposed to local is one of the biggest reasons, in my opinion, that people do not vote in off years. Why should they care? It says that we're desperately uninformed on local issues and politicians. Now, I will say here in WITF, we try to do our best to do that.
Sure.
But one of the things that has occurred is the demise of local newspapers and the kind of coverage you get. But what would you how do you respond to what Rebecca has to say?
Oh, I think she's right on. I mean, the problem with the coverage is that you could have 5, 6, 7 candidates running. Remember, we're talking about nominating people now, nominating, not electing in the vast majority of cases. So you could have 5 or 6 people running for a Court of Common Pleas office. You could have 6 or 7 people running for 2 nominations to township supervisor. You could have 10, 12 people running for nominations for 3 school board memberships. You get my point. We're talking about 30 to 40 people on a ballot, and it's overwhelming in that sense for the media to provide extensive coverage. And I do think the media, I mean, I think there's great efforts made, but it's too overwhelming. And I think that, and then add to that, we elect positions that we shouldn't be electing because they're administrative. They're not policy making. Why would we be electing a prothonotary? Why would we be electing a clerk of court? Why would we be electing a recorder of deeds or a register of wills. Why would we be electing a coroner, for gosh sake?
Hey, Terry, I have to interrupt you because we're out of time. But real quick, so what to look for next in 2020?
Well, I think what we going to look for next is what happens with the Democrats and impeachment. I know it's something that you're going to air a good bit of coverage over. What do the Democrats do in terms of the impeachment, and do they move forward, and in what way does that shape or reshape the presidential election?
Dr. G. Terry Madonna, Franklin Marshall College. Terry, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And we're going to have a lot more discussion on these issues over the next 18 months, that's for sure. Tomorrow, we talk about vacationing tourism in Pennsylvania.